All right. Well, we're going to turn into IREST and trauma. As you know, IREST is a trauma-informed protocol. And as we go into this talk, what I want to start with is to emphasize that you can trust the protocol. We've done the research. We know it works. Trust the protocol, trust the protocol, trust the protocol. But let's start off so that we're on the same page of what do I mean by trauma? So trauma can be any distressing or disturbing experience that someone's had or some sort of stress injury that someone's had. And it doesn't, when I'm talking about trauma, I'm not just necessarily discussing the most extreme forms of trauma. Not everyone develops post-traumatic stress. We can have acute trauma that we need to work with as well. I've said it before in this training, we can have trauma from, tripping over something and breaking a bone, from watching a car accident happen or experiencing that. We can have it from being at war and other, violence and things like that as well. But it doesn't have to be the most excessive experiences. And one of the things, I love a couple of quotes from Stephen Porges, who is a psychologist that is the creator of polyvagal theory. And polyvagal is a theory, and it looks at the nervous system and the just how it's kind of been formed from a different angle. And he says trauma replaces patterns of connection with patterns of protection. Trauma replaces patterns of connection with patterns of protection. And another quote by him is, "Trauma is a chronic disruption of connectedness." And isn't that true? Right? Because our nervous system is built actually for, so, you want me to say that one again? It's a chronic disruption of connectedness. So, our nervous system was developed and built not just for our survival, but for our sense of connection with one another. We're social animals. So, it's there both for our sense of connectedness with one another, our ability to thrive, as well as survive. And when we've experienced trauma, we experience a loss of control, a loss of a sense of safety. And there's some great implications here. We feel a disconnection with ourself. When we've experienced trauma, we feel a disconnection with others. It can impact our sleep. Oftentimes, for people that have experienced trauma, they have sleep disorders or disordered sleeping of some sort. It can impact our levels of experience of pain. It can impact depression and anxiety. So it's really important to understand that, and then in the more extreme experiences of trauma, then we have things like hypervigilance, hyper alertness, and overall hypoarousal or hyperarousal of our nervous system, where we're just heightened. And even in neutral environments, we're scanning, we're overreacting to something that might be happening in our environment as if it's extremely stressful, because it is extremely stressful for our system. So I'd like to just give a brief overview of the brain on trauma, right? Of our nervous system and what happens, particularly in our brain and in our nervous system in general. So the traditional understanding of the nervous system is we have the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. Most of us know this. I'm not going to go into great detail. The sympathetic, is there, it serves us. If we didn't have the sympathetic system online, we wouldn't wake up in the morning. It gets our heart beating. right? It helps us to digest our food. You know, it gets the mind body kind of ready for action for the day, right? And in more stressful experiences, it's going to do things like open up our airways so that we can get more oxygen. It's going to stop our digestion and get our blood flowing down to our limbs so that we can either flee the situation and run away or we can fight, right? So that's, you know, the healthy part of our sympathetic nervous system all the way to the part where it helps us to survive. Then we have the parasympathetic nervous system, and this is responsible for our relaxation response. It's considered the rest and digest part of our system. This is what's responsible for slowing down our heartbeat and having our blood pressure lowered. It brings out positive hormones that allow our body to have a sense of ease and a sense of relaxation. And then we have these parts of the brain that are implicated when we're undergoing and experiencing trauma. And it has to do with our limbic system, which is the non-thinking, reactive part of our brain. And it's responsible for our survival responses as well. And there's a couple of key parts of the brain that are important to understand in regards to trauma. And one is the amygdala, and the other is the hippocampus. And the amygdala is, you can think of the amygdala as the first responder. So it's taking in information about our environment through the five senses. And it's then sending messengers to our body to respond to stress. So it's putting out all the hormones and the chemicals that our body needs to be able to come into fight or flight. It's telling the body when, you know, it's revving up the sympathetic nervous system, right? It's kind of the supervisor, that first responder that's telling everybody, go. Then we have the hippocampus. And what happens with the hippocampus is it's, you can think of it as our time date stamp, you know? And when there are stress hormones that flood our brain, cortisol and other chemicals that are released, the hippocampus goes online. And the hippocampus is also helpful in having some context for what's happening, contextualizing the situation. And it connects with our frontal cortex, our prefrontal cortex in that way. And so if it goes offline, we don't have that time date stamp that's there. And that has implications for when people have flashbacks, right? And so during trauma, if somebody's experienced extreme levels of trauma or trauma for longer periods of time, the amygdala in their brain actually enlarges and the hippocampus shrinks. The other thing that happens when the amygdala is in full force is that the frontal cortex also goes offline. And that's responsible for planning and for rational thought. So if you were in an extremely stressful situation and later on you're like, what was I thinking? In a way, you weren't thinking in a rational way. You were in reactivity mode, right? So what's great about any of the practices that we do that balance the nervous system and enhance the parasympathetic nervous system is that research shows that it actually shrinks the amygdala and grows the hippocampus, right? So that's the neuroplasticity that Jennifer was talking about earlier. So any practices, but that includes eye rest, that's what's going to happen for people that have experienced extreme stress. The other thing that I think is really important to emphasize here is that we're not responsible for how our nervous system reacts to any acute stressor. It's out of our conscious control. And that's extremely important, especially for people that have had moral injury or some other injury, during being at war or some other situation. It was people that experienced and were there at 9/11. Some people ran for miles and miles and miles, ran across bridges and landed themselves in New Jersey after watching what happened and being there when the towers came down. Others completely collapsed to the ground. Others ran in and tried to save people. And what we know from the therapists and different healers that worked with people that experienced 9/11 is many of them felt guilty. And that's true of some people that have experienced war or any other type of trauma. They feel guilty. It's that something's wrong with me versus something was extremely wrong, right? Yes, of course there was something wrong, but how easy it is to say there's something wrong with me. Why didn't I stay and help? Why was I in New Jersey, right? They blame themselves as if they had some sense of control. Why couldn't I have helped other people and instead I collapsed or I froze and I couldn't move? And what's really healing in the process over time is when they come to truly understand that what's happened was out of their conscious control, completely out of their conscious control. So as far as adapting the protocol for people that have experienced trauma, what we know is if we've experienced trauma, we need to have a sense now of choice, of predictability, and of control. And for some people, we need to have a better sense of time, right? We need to understand what's happening, how long things are going to happen, because if my hippocampus has gone offline and I've lost sense of a time date stamp, sometimes that can be very disconcerting to us, right? So you've noticed that throughout, Jennifer and I have tried to talk about, this is what we're going to be doing. This is about how long we're going to be doing this here and there, right? I'm going to talk to you. We're going to talk for a few minutes when I've done the interviewing. I've said, we're going to talk for a few minutes, 5-10 minutes. Then we're going to come into a practice. Then at the end, I'm going to bring you out for about 10 minutes. That was intentional, right? We don't always have to do it. It is important to let people know, though, what's happening as an overview of what we're doing, because that gives them a sense of control and choice. If I talk about what we're focusing on in today's practice, and there's somebody in my room, because I always presume somebody in my class has experienced trauma. They may never come up and talk to me about it, but we've all experienced trauma to some degree, and some more so than others. So I'm going to presume that somebody in my class has experienced trauma. And if I let them know what we're going to focus on today, especially if we're going to change the body sensing in some way, or we're going to try a new breath sensing, I'm doing that and I'm talking about it. I want to talk about the benefits so that when somebody is ready to go into the practice, their mind isn't trying to stay alert, trying to figure out what's coming next and why are we doing this, right? It helps to quiet their mind. I've fed it what it needs. They understand the benefits and why we're changing something slightly, if we're going to change it. Understanding this, this is also why we don't change the protocol super often, right? And if we're going to start to build on new koshas, we explain it. And we're doing some of the groundwork, and we always weave in what we've done before as we're building on new koshas, if we're offering an 8-week series, let's say, right? Because then they could possibly think, oh, okay, I don't want to do that breathing practice. That sounds really stressful for me. And now they have a choice to choose to do maybe the breathing practice that works for them, right? So we want to set up the class. We want to, if there were a bunch of closed cabinets here, I might casually just open the cabinets, especially if I was offering a class for people that had experienced trauma. Because otherwise, they might be wondering what's behind these closed doors, right? I'm making sure that I've got, you know, Janice is near that door. Suzanne's over here near this door. I have my eyes on the doors. If it was a class that was specifically for people that have experienced trauma, I might ask them, what do you prefer? Do you prefer I teach by the door, or just are you okay if I sit here and you know I've got my eyes on the door, right? Ideally, if it's a specialized class for people that have experienced trauma, I always love to have an assistant so that I can teach where I can teach. I let them know I've got my eyes on everybody, everyone in the room and the doors, but I've also got an assistant. That also helps if people leave the room. I always have an agreement that if somebody needs to leave the room, that they're checking in with me before we end our class period, right? So we've got to check in so I can support them to ground. It's very rare, but I always have that, ask for that agreement. When we're offering the practice, the fact that we're helping people to understand what's coming, that gives some sense of predictability. As I was saying, with predictability, allows their nervous system to calm down. It allows them to have some choice. We titrate emotions, beliefs, memories. So when we talk with them about building a continuum, or even if I don't talk about building a continuum, I always say we're going to work with emotions, and I don't expect you to work with your most intense emotion. Because why would we do that to our nervous system? We don't want to flood ourselves, right? And a weave in the inner resource whenever we're working with emotions and beliefs and joy. Because for some people, joy is really tricky. It wasn't safe in their house to feel joy. They got in trouble if they felt joy or expressed exuberance or happiness in some way. Or worse. Or maybe some people, it just makes them cry because they don't have access to joy. And that just feels awful, you know? So I'm always weaving an inner resource with emotions, beliefs, and joy. That helps people to titrate so that they begin to have that emotional regulation and they're starting to build that sense of control for themselves. And by doing all of this, and especially weaving in the inner resource, which is a key factor of making this trauma informed, it helps people to build their resilience, right? To increase that window of tolerance so their system can actually tolerate greater degrees of stress and be able to come back to their kind of more baseline, calm nervous system. See if there was anything else I wanted to say about that. Just that, I have until the top of the hour, right? I have another half an hour? Okay. So I guess I'd just like to say that, you know, if someone were to start to have an emotional catharsis while you're teaching your class, there's something called abreaction, right? And an abreaction is an opposite reaction to what you normally would think might happen. But we think of abreaction as a simple emotional catharsis, just a catharsis that happens. That's a natural part of healing. I'm going to say that again. An emotional response is a natural part of healing. And I'm going to say it one more time. Having an emotional response is a natural part of healing as we disidentify and we bring home all those parts that have felt broken into our sense of wholeness. As we revisit and we chew it up and we digest it and we integrate it, we're going to meet the parts that were hard and we're going to have emotional reactions, emotional responses. Hopefully not the same reactivity that we had before, but we're going to have emotional responses. It doesn't mean that anything's wrong. It's a part of healing, right? The other thing to remember is that as we welcome in our wholeness, and as people touch in to a sense of wholeness, it may be the first time that they've ever felt this in their entire lives. And that too can bring a great emotional release. People can weep, have great like weeping sessions of just crying. It's happened to me, just tears, heartbroken, wide open from wonder of this sense of truly not being separate from anything that was arising. And I was on a retreat crying so hard at the beauty and the awe and the wonder. I felt no separation anywhere, utter wholeness and openness everywhere. And someone was on that retreat, was a therapist, by the way, my fellow psychotherapist, was a therapist, came over, she was a participant of the retreat, came over, sat next to me, this was years and years ago, sat next to me, didn't let me know she was there, didn't ask my permission, not only touched my wrist, told me I was okay, that everything was okay, but put a Kleenex in my hand. So that's what I'm talking about people feeling like they need to take care of someone, assuming that I was having a negative experience, which I wasn't. I was having the most profound experience I'd ever had in my life. It was utterly beautiful. But watch that negativity bias and all the assumptions and that part that starts to take over that wanted to fix it and wanted to make me feel better. It was infuriating, I can tell you that. And it brought me right up and out for a little while of the experience. So I had to open my eyes, take care of this person who thinks they're taking care of me. Now I'm taking care of her and saying, I'm fine. Please go away in the nicest way possible. So I'm sharing this for you all as teachers, as meditation, yoga teachers, whatever kind of teacher. This is, we need to watch and start to learn and track this part of us that is starting to make assumptions. And we can't help it. It's just what happens. It's our own nervous system getting triggered. But that's why our own practice is so important. We don't have to presume that somebody that's starting to cry in the corner of our group class is having a bad experience. I don't have to presume that somebody that's flipping and flopping, opening their eyes, moving around, I don't presume that they're not in the practice. That's come to bite me right in the butt. I've checked in with somebody after class. I'm thinking there's something that was coming up for them. So I checked in. Hey, how's it going? Thank goodness I didn't say all kinds of other things. Like, oh, I noticed that you're not in the practice. I was wise enough. I didn't say that. I just checked in and say, hey, how's the practice going? They were like, oh my gosh, that was the greatest practice. I was so deep in. They looked like a fish flip-flopping over in the corner. I saw their eyes opening. They said, your voice just went in the background. I was meeting all of this. They'd start telling me all these things that were happening. We don't know. But our mind thinks that we know. So here's what you can do. Here's what we can do. Check your own self first and just ground in your own inner resource. Ground down. Feel that sense of welcoming presence. Feel that ground of being, right? Regulate yourself first. And then we can simply go over to that area of the room. Remember where I talked about our presence is the field? And our resonance is feeling the vibration within the field. We can feel resonance in the field. That means our students can potentially also pick up on our resonance, right? So I'm going to go over, and if I had more room, I'd stand up and I'd walk and I'd show you. But I'm going to go over and walk in this corner of the room. I would have told my students ahead of time, if you know you're going to want the option to do this, always tell your students, I might walk around the room while I'm teaching the practice, so you might hear my voice changing from direction. I'll tell you why, and I'll come back to what we're going to do in a second. I did not do that once. This was probably in the last 2 years. I forgot to do it. And actually, I think it might have been in a training. I forgot to do it. Doesn't matter. Wherever I was, I forgot to do it. And someone let me know afterwards that it was extremely disruptive for them and that it brought them out of the practice. Basically, you know, without saying it, it was a trigger for their own trauma by hearing my voice so close to them. They weren't prepared for that. And it was scary. And oh boy, was that a lesson and a reminder. And I thanked them and I apologized. So let your class know if you think you might move around, that that's a possibility. Then that way, if somebody starts to cry, you can walk over. So I'm walking over to that side of the room. And at first, I'm just teaching from that side of the room. So my presence is here and I'm tracking. And that person, that may be enough. They might settle or they might still be crying slightly. I'm okay with that. If they start to cry a little bit more intensely, now I might go over and teach more from around where their feet are. I'm not going to walk right up by their shoulders and head because that's just getting all in their space and that's not appropriate. But I might, you know, crouch down more towards their legs or near their waist, right? And I might just crouch down on my knees or just sit down and still teach the class, but I'm a little closer. Right? Now I'm teaching. And if they're continuing to cry, I might just crouch down and just check in and say, and whisper, I'm here. Just checking if everything's okay. You're among friends. Right? Whatever emotion is moving through is welcome here. I'm not necessarily saying all of that, but I have the option to say any one of those things. But I'm letting them know I'm here. And they may nod, you know, or they may not respond. And I'm okay with that because I know they know that I'm here, right? I keep teaching. So I'm teaching in my regular voice to the rest of the class. If it gets louder, I'm letting them know, you know, let me know if there's anything you need. If not, I'm just going to keep, you know, I'm going to continue to teach. But if you need anything, I'm here. I'm not going to presume, unless they open their eyes and they let me know they need to come out, I'm going to keep teaching. And I've just let them know and whispered down the things that I've said. Let me know if you need any support. Then I keep teaching. Now, if they've gotten so loud that others in the room can hear it, I can just incorporate, just noticing the sounds that are happening. That the sounds that are coming and going and noticing how this lands, what's happening in the body, emotions that may be coming or going, right? There's ways, just like I would if there was a siren that was going by. And you might weave in the inner resource if it feels right. And then I'm going on and I'm continuing to teach. And then if somebody opens their eyes and says they want to come out, I'm going to help them ground. If it feels right, you can feel your inner resource. Would it feel helpful? Feel your feet on the ground. Open your eyes. You know, feel breathing down through your feet. Let me know what you need. Again, if they need to leave the room, which has been, I don't know that that's happened to me once, one time since like 2008. And we just had an agreement that they would wait outside and we checked in at the end. Okay. All right. Okay. So what I'd love to do now is talk about the neuroscience of meditation. And I have some slides to walk us through that. So I'm going to switch gears. And so Denny Shea, would you mind bringing that up? And could we go to let's see if it comes up. Denisha or us, Kajal, I think is, thank you, perfect. It's up for us. We've got it. Suzanne, thank you. So this is the neuroscience of meditation. So we're going to switch gears for a moment. Actually, before we do, can we go back a slide, Kajal? I feel like that was just such an abrupt jump. So I do have a few minutes. Are there any questions about what I talked about so far around this being a trauma-informed practice, or any of the questions, any questions about what I've shared? Yes, I'll make sure that these slides that are coming up will be on the learning resource page at the end. Mm-hmm. But any other questions from those of you at home? Or yeah, we have a question here. Uh-huh. I'll repeat the question. You want to run the mic.
Talking specifically about ab reactions, in my experience working as a therapist, sometimes ab reactions are bodily functions. I was just wondering if you've seen that show up in class. And I'm assuming it's the same kind of, but maybe it's not. How do you respond to that? They might yawn, they might have gas, they might like all kinds of different things.
Oh yes, gas happens. It all happens. If it's those types of bodily responses in a group, I don't say anything. No. I just, I'm just teaching, and I know that just like if people were flipping and flopping, and they do, I'm just continuing to teach the protocol. Mm-hmm. And if I'm having a one-on-one with someone or I'm doing a core meditation dyad and they start to cry or they start to swallow or they yawn, I don't point it out necessarily. I'm just with them, and then I just might say, and what's present now? And then they're going in and they're reporting out to whatever degree they want to. Yeah. Yep. Any other questions? Yep, we have another question here in the room. Thanks, Suzanne.
It's just, I guess, like a little technical question about the policy, or like having a policy in place when someone, if they need to leave the room during practice, and then you said like having them check in after that at the end and like reground them. So I guess it's just a question of, is it something that you say at the beginning of class, like if you leave the room, check with me at the end, and then when you check, they check in at the end. Is it that they stay in their place in the room and you come to that, or they come to you and then you say, how was that? And then you like cue them to reground, or just kind of give them that reminder of like, take your time leaving the space, and in case like if you're driving and things like that.
Yeah, it's really, really rare that, like I said, that anybody would ever leave. But like for a series class, I always make that agreement that if something were to come up, I mean, I don't make too big of a deal out of it, because you know how sometimes if you emphasize something, then people are like, they're kind of looking for it. Or, just making an agreement that, obviously if somebody really, I always encourage people if something's coming up, they feel like they need to move or something like that, just check in with it first, see if they can meet it in the meditation. And then, yeah, if not, and they need to leave for whatever reason, they're welcome to come back at any time, right? So I don't want them to feel like if they leave the room, they can't come back. But if something were to come up and for whatever reason, somebody felt like they weren't going to be able to stay in the room, that they come and check in with me at the end. And then I'm just always make myself available for 15 minutes after class, no matter what, right? No matter what. And yeah, they usually come to me, right? We'll wait until everybody leaves, and then we'll walk up to each other. You kind of feel into it. If they're waiting for you, I'll go to them and I'll just ask, how was the practice? You want to talk about anything that came up? I'd love to see if I can support you in any way. And then that's where we have the skills of the co-meditation dyad. That's exactly why we're doing that. We don't expect you to go hang up a shingle. We don't expect people to have a private practice that they're doing with this, unless you're really skilled and that's something you're already doing. You're a yoga therapist, or you can get mentoring to support you if you want, but that's not our expectation, right? It's really for these situations because we're in a co-meditation dyad with our neighbors, with our friends, with our family. There might be times we can use these skills in a lot of different situations, but especially after class, if something like this has happened. That way you're not trying to fix and change them. And then this is when it's important to have resources available so that if somebody does need a therapist or, I don't know, a massage therapist or, we've got resources that we can support people with if they would like them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. How about I move into the neuroscience of meditation because I would like some time to walk through this with you. And I don't know that I'll have time to go into much of the polyvagal, but I promise that I will get to that, if not now and before the end of the training. Yep. Okay. I think Kajal's doing this for me. So Kajal, we'll go to the next slide, please. So there's a few different areas of the brain, the neuroscience I think it's good to understand. And you'll get these slides. We have this talk in level 2. We have some workshops that Richard Miller has done that goes into this as well. So if this is interesting, this doesn't have to be the only time that you hear about this. There are different parts of the brain that are active in our everyday thinking, alert state of consciousness. One is the default network. And the default network is responsible for our ego identity. It's our autobiographical sense of self. That part of us, that I, me, mine, the ego I that has a past, present, and future, right? If we think about our sense of personality and the sense of being who we are, we all pretty much identify with having our history and our past, our present day circumstances, and we all project into the future. The default network or the default mode network is another way that it's called, the DMN, the default mode network, also is responsible for recursive thinking that can be positive or negative. So recursive thinking is when you've got those thinking loops that just continue and you kind of ruminate over and over again. You know, when you get that song stuck in your head and you can't get it out, that's, the default mode network is online when that's happening. And the negativity bias, we all have it. How sweet it was when I asked for examples of beliefs and we all came up with the negative beliefs, right? Or if you ask your class to give you examples of emotions, a lot of times we'll get a lot of negative emotions first rather than the positive. It's just part of our nervous system. We're just built that way. But we can also have some positive aspects to the default mode network. We do daydream in the default mode network is online, and some of that brings a level of creativity, right? But, you could think of it as this self-referential kind of aspect of our thinking mind and of our brain. It's that color commentator that's kind of always in the background narrating your experience. Gary Weber, he's a meditation teacher. He calls it the blah, blah network. Blah, blah, blah. So that's the default mode network. Then we have our dorsal attention network. And that's responsible for learning how to focus our attention and to focus our concentration. And it is responsible for our planning and encoding our coping strategies. And then we have the executive control network. And that is responsible for holding attention for longer periods of time. And it can coordinate and override the attention network. So it can override it and decide how long we're going to focus attention. And it kind of switches between the default mode network and the dorsal attention network. And what's interesting about the executive control network is that we don't need a self-referencing ego for it to function. How interesting is that? There's a part of our system, there's a part of our brain that is responsible for our focused concentration and attention, our executive functioning that doesn't need a self-referencing ego. There's this reference to a book by Michael Gazzaniga called The Mind's Past, and it's referenced in the manual. And he did studies, this was years ago, and the parts of the brain that light up when we're feeling a sense of our ego eye that's responsible for something, it actually lit up 200 to 500 milliseconds after our body already did an action, right? So our hand pulls away from a stove, a hot stove. It's 200 to 500 milliseconds later that our eye thought will come online and think, I withdrew my hand. The action was already happening. Fascinating, right? Okay, next slide, please. So this is just the different areas of the brain. You can see the attention networks in red, the executive control is green, and the default mode network is in blue. And they all kind of coordinate together. Okay, next slide, please. Then we have something, Richard likes to call it the present-centered network. It's, if you look up the research, it's going to be called the defocusing network. And it counterbalances the default mode network. It reduces our beta brainwaves. So the beta brainwaves are there when we're in our alert kind of everyday thinking mind, like we are right now. We have beta that's going on, right? And what the research shows is when the defocusing network comes online, which is over here in this kind of right side near our ear, as it comes online, there's an increased gamma waves that happen in our brain. And this is really, really interesting. There was a book written by a few neuroscientists that study meditation. I don't have their names on the top of my head right now, but they wrote a book called Altered Traits. And it was an excellent book about meditation. And what they did is they did some research. It was Richie Davidson out of University of Wisconsin in Madison. And they did some research on what they call Olympic meditators, which I love that phrase. I think it's so hilarious and cute. But these are the meditators, these are the lamas, you know, with the Dalai Lama, that have, they've all been meditating for over 62,000 hours in their lifetime, right? And what they showed is they had gamma waves, which gamma waves, I have a little note here because I always want to remember this. Of course, I can't find my note now. But gamma waves are the... Here are my notes. Gamma waves are when we have gamma synchronization, it's where we have our most, these brain waves are kind of going in sync, and they're our highest frequency brain waves and the strongest frequency brain waves on the EEG spectrum. And when we're feeling, when gamma's released, we feel happy, we feel receptive, it increases awareness and mindfulness, and it's associated with higher brain functioning, increased cognition, memory, problem solving, right? So what's really fascinating is gamma is released. Like, let's say you've been struggling with a problem and for months, and then all of a sudden you solve it. Gamma waves are released in your brain for about a half a second. A half a second, we get the gamma waves, right? And gamma waves are released if you even imagine biting into an apple and you can hear the crisp bite and the taste and all of that unfolds and gamma's released. These meditators that have meditated over 62,000 hours have gamma all the time, no matter what they're doing. No matter what they're doing in their life, they always have gamma. And when it asks them to do meditations on, do a compassion meditation, their gamma waves increased 700 to 800 times. So they've never seen any of this in any research. We don't even know what that means, that they have gamma happening all the time. But what the hypothesis is that this is awakening, that this is an indicator of awakening. We'll see, right? We'll see. But that sense of awareness that's present. So what happens with the defocusing network is that, and this is what comes online when we're experiencing being. Thank you, Denny Kajal, for putting up Altered Traits by Daniel Goldman and Richie Davidson. So what happens in being is that we're moving beyond the sense of separation. We don't feel separate. And we start to open in, and this happens with the defocusing network and the present-centered network. We have a sense of infinite possibility. We feel spacious and unboundaried. We move beyond time. We feel a sense of timelessness. That's what people describe when they're under an fMRI or EEG. I don't know what the test is. And they're more in the defocusing network. They describe losing a sense of boundary. They start to feel boundaryless. They have a deep sense of equanimity and well-being. It completely overcomes the negativity bias. And we have infinite insight, infinite potential, spacious, open. If we're beyond time and we don't have a sense of past, present, and future, and we're feeling spacious, we're unboundaried, what does that mean about feeling a separate sense of self? How can we have, remember earlier in the default mode network, when we have that autobiographical sense of self, it has a sense of past, present, and future. It has a sense of boundary. So if we're in the defocusing network or the present-centered network and all of that drops away, which happens when we're experiencing being or awareness, we're opening into our non-separate wholeness, right? Okay. Next slide. So this is what happens when we're in meditation. Next slide, please. Mm-hmm. So in meditation, we're switching off, we don't ever switch it completely off, but we're downgrading the default mode network, the areas of the brain that are self-referencing and those wandering thoughts that give rise to stress, anxiety, fear, or experiencing a separate sense of self. So that goes, quote, offline, where it's not as active. And we're switching on the present-centered network, the defocusing network, where we have increased gamma in our ability to access equanimity, the infinite possibilities, the insight, that spontaneous insight, creativity, that we're moving beyond a sense of time, a sense of space. We're opening into our spacious wholeness, what's called in meditation the non-self. So next slide, please. So let's talk about how we can do this in meditation and in the practices that we do. When we sense opposites, when I ask you to feel your right hand, not think about it, not imagine it, but move all the way down and feel it. Not just your attention moving towards it, but your attention moving from within and feel your right hand. Then I ask you to feel your left hand. And I'm going to ask you to do this right now. Feel your right hand. Let go of writing. I promise all these slides will be given to you at the end. Just feel your right hand for the moment. How it's tingling. Feel the center of the palm. The back of the hand. Now shift your attention. Feel the left hand. The center of the palm. Inside each finger, the back of the hand. Now feel the right hand again. Felt sense. All your attention inside the right hand. And the left hand. Now feel both hands at the same time. What just happened to your thinking mind? When you feel both hands, what happens to your thinking mind? Anybody, you can put it in the chat or you can call it out. Stepped back from it. Mm-hmm. Quiets. Did you see how the thinking drops away? It's just feeling. Did anybody start to feel more open and spacious? Maybe, maybe not. But that's the potential. As we feel two opposites, this is potential. It potentiates us opening into the present center or defocusing network of the brain. Anytime we feel two opposites, that means two opposites of emotion, belief. So I'm just going to keep going for just a couple more minutes and then we'll come into our break just because I want to finish this slide, these slides. So the next slide, please. So this felt sense of being, and we're going to do this tomorrow. When we're opening into being, there are five key questions. These are called the Kanchukas in Sanskrit. And I'll write that up for you. We'll have a little page that has Kanchukas on it, or I'll spell it tomorrow, but it's K-A-N-C-H-U-K-A-S. But I'll repeat it tomorrow. So all of these questions come from this ancient map of meditation, and they open us to our sense of being. So when we ask, where am I when I'm just being? We can feel into our greater spaciousness. We can sense when we're not in being and we're feeling more of our separate sense of self. We feel bordered and boundaried. But when we're opening up as being, we go beyond border and boundary. We're no longer contracted and limited. When am I when I'm simply being? And I don't want you to just think about this. I want you to drop into being now. You can do this as a mini meditation. Just sit back. You don't have to worry about knowing this. What's more important is that you feel it. When you're just being, do you need more time? Or can you open into the timelessness, being beyond time? When you're in the middle of the meditation, do you know how much time has gone by? Absolutely not. Some meditations are like the fastest. It's like a blink of an eye, and others feel like you could have been there for like 2 hours. That's moving beyond that sense of time. That's indicative that you've dropped into this essence of being. How am I? What am I? Who am I? So we'll walk through these questions more experientially and take this as its own meditation. In fact, I'll do this meditation first thing in the morning before we even do our talk, okay? Just so we can have more time. But for the sake of time now, we'll move into the next slide. So these are all ways in the practices that we potentiate opening up the defocusing or present-centered network. So whenever we drop into being, whenever we feel opposites, and whenever we move from the witness into witnessing. So that experiment that we run where you feel yourself as a witness or an observer of everything that's arising, where and how do you feel being a witness or an observer in your body? Usually we feel a little bit more separate, like it's out there and we're here as the witness or the observer. And then allow yourself as a witness to dissolve into being witnessing. And notice where and how you feel this in the body. You might not only feel it in the body, but it might start to feel more expansive. As we're doing this, being witnessing, we have a relationship with it. We feel like we're being with it. We can touch into it, and yet it's arising in us. We're starting to feel that greater spaciousness. So this is another way that we might be opening into the defocusing or the present-centered network. And then the next slide, please. Now we're opening into being awareness. Awareness is what we're going to move into tomorrow in great length. As we work through as Mitamaya and we see through the ego eye and the separate I thought, then we open up to being and awareness. We notice, we've talked about this a little bit before, how everything's arising in awareness. And we can then bring our attention, well, what is this felt sense of awareness in which all these objects are coming and going? And then we can allow our attention to dissolve into being awareness. And how there's no qualifier. And I'll go into this more tomorrow. It's unborn, it's unconditioned, it's transparent. There's nothing that we can hang on awareness. And then we can notice how it's present and how the I thought will come in and try to capture it. But we release the tension from whatever arises, and then it might fall back into awareness itself. Next slide. So we have these resources as we're opening into our wholeness of being, where as we're nourishing being and we're orienting to that sense of well-being or just this essence or this ease of being, where we're increasing our insight, this possibility of infinite possibility. We feel a greater wholeness. We start to feel a sense of ability to focus, to give us a sense of greater control. And we're generating a sense of interoceptive awareness where we have this relationship somatically with our body, and we can feel the movements of mind, our senses, our emotions, our beliefs, our cognitions, all as sensations. So we're getting that full biofeedback mechanism of the body-mind connection. Through the practice of meditation, we're repairing the negative recursive thinking. And what's replacing it is we have greater creativity, greater spontaneity, authenticity. And we're starting to regulate our system, aren't we? And what are we restoring through this practice? Hopefully all of this isn't news to you. It's just like, oh yeah, I felt that. Oh yeah, that makes sense. I've experienced that. Or, I'm looking forward to that if you haven't yet. But we're restoring that inner and outer connection and harmony with ourself and with the world around us. Because when we feel that interconnectedness, we're not just feeling that harmony within ourselves, we're feeling it with everything. We start to feel interconnected with that universal life force, with that flow of life. It feels right. We have a greater sense of empathy, a greater sense of joy, equanimity, well-being, right? We're building our emotional intelligence, our emotional sensitivity, our empathy, and we're building a sense of resilience and flexibility, and we're reducing our stress, and hopefully we're getting much better sleep over time. So I think that's the last slide. We can go to the next slide because it just is really, really cute. So that's how we feel on iRest, joy and delight. So thank you. I know I went over. Let me look at the schedule. I'll regroup a little bit. I promised you I'd finish, but I really, that's what I get for doing Q&A before the trauma and neuroscience talk. I'll know next time to not do that. So how about we take a 10-minute break and we start back at 20 after, and that still gives Jennifer 40 minutes for her practice. Does that work? Jennifer, I hope that works for you, and my sincerest heartfelt apologies. I know we all want your delicious practice to the end of the day. Thanks, everybody. Hopefully that wasn't too boring and we still got you with us. We'll see you back in 10 minutes.